What's terrible might me? This is It Could Happen Here, a podcast about collapse. And that's appropriate because everyone's faith in me as a colleague has collapsed today as the result of a series of horrific clusterfucks on my part. I'm late to the meeting. I accidentally left the meeting when they started recording. Just a complete fucking shit show.
Yes.
Speaking of shit shows, my co-host, Garrison Davis. How are you, Garrison?
Thank you. I'm the one that saved this. I had to send the guest the Zoom call.
I know.
I'm not even supposed to be on this call.
No, you're not. You're not even supposed to be working today. That's not true.
Well, yeah.
But you're not on this call.
Not on this call, but here I am, saving the pod.
This is enough. This is enough witty banter. This is a daily podcast.
Yeah.
All right.
And now let's bring on our guest for today, Monsignor Alex Newhouse. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I feel like I was pulled in off the street, just like bundled into a van and then...
Yeah, yeah. You know how people used to get like shanghaied, like captured by...
Allegedly.
And forced to work on boats in like San Francisco and whatnot. We do that with podcasts.
I mean, that is actually most of what I've done to the people who work on your podcast. I think I've had everyone from your show on our show now, and it has been very much like I'm just pulling them on a string.
Speaking of which, Alex, you are one of the hosts of the Terrorism is Bad podcast, a very controversially named podcast, and you work at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey Center of Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism. Center on, not of. That would be a different center.
Very important. Yeah. Middle word there.
And
we're not bringing you on to talk about how to make explosively formed penetrators.
Not this time.
That is someone else. Yeah. But you are also a actual games journalist.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got my start in this weird space via Gamergate.
How do you feel about ethics in the game journalism industry, Alex?
It's always been fine. Like, people lost their shit.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anyway, that's the end of that.
Yeah. I do want to actually start there, Alex, because you and I both have something in common, which is that we got our start writing in a field that's wildly different from consulting with like governments on terrorism. Like, for me, it was I wanted to write like dick jokes on the internet, and I just like stumbled into a bunch of ISIS propaganda that most people weren't aware of. And that started me like lecturing at universities and shit. Yeah. And for you, it was Gamergate. So I'm interested in kind of you telling your story a little bit to start us off.
Yeah. So I was during undergrad, I interned every summer at GameSpot, a video game website you may have heard of. It's one of the two big ones along with IGN. And when I was doing that, this was 2014, 2015, 2016, like right at the beginning stages of Gamergate really popping off. And what ended up happening is a lot of the people I worked with, a lot of my colleagues and friends, were just in the blast zone. They were just targeted by the absolute onslaught of harassment. And I just out of curiosity started looking into some of those people who were targeting my friends and colleagues, and it ended up being a lot of the people that we're still talking about today. You know, it all rolls back up to the Breitbart metropolitan area, if you will.
Yeah. And I don't know. The thing that made me want to, I mean, obviously I've been aware of your work for a while, but the thing that made me want to specifically bring you on is you started on a new project to create like a video game that will hopefully have an ability to help like de-radicalize people. And I'm not entirely certain like of the details of the project, but I think it's a fascinating project because as you know all too well, a lot of this stuff started in gaming, not as a result of anything specifically about gaming, but the kind of like socialization that occurs in those spaces and the kind of like different communities. And it's been like we have going back to the 90s evidence of like different Nazi groups on the early internet, like talking about like these are specific groups and subcultures that, you know, will have an easier time radicalizing and whatnot. But yeah, I'm interested in kind of what actually is going on with this project and how you think it's going to look at this stage. I understand it's pretty early in development right now, so I'm not expecting, like, you know, an E3 walkthrough.
Yeah, our E3 Slice of Life demo. I wish we had that. Yeah, we won a grant from DHS and FEMA, their terrorism prevention grant program this year. We just got awarded it, like, literally 2 weeks ago, so have not even started work on it at all. But the project will be a collaboration between my center and a nonprofit games development company called the iThrive Foundation. And basically what we are going to do is like build digital scenarios, digital narratives that can be engaged with within classroom settings. So we're targeting high schools for rolling this out. And the idea is that we're going to give students the ability to take on roles that empower them to better understand how extremism and radicalization work as mechanisms, which will hopefully, the idea is that it will improve resilience and, you know, civil integrity and all those fun buzzwords within high school communities. So we're not necessarily trying to de-radicalize already radicalized people, but we're really trying to build community awareness, community resilience to radicalization pathways.
I mean, this is something I think about constantly because I get asked this a lot. You know, I'll get emailed questions from people, sometimes as much detail as like, hey, I'm like a teacher and here's some things this kid in my class has said or something he put in an essay. And like, I'm growing really concerned about him and like, I what do I do? And my usual answer is, you know, there's a couple of people who I respect that I'll try to direct them to. But I'm pretty good at how people get radicalized. It's something I spend a lot of time studying. I don't know I have trouble figuring out how to break down these pathways. Cause like, right. The default for a lot of people and for a lot of time has been, well, you deplatform them, right? You get them off of whatever. And I certainly think there's utility in that, but there's also, you know, the toothpaste tube effect. The fact that when you squash these popular areas where they're able to spread, then they filter off into increasingly isolated communities. They develop new terms. They find out ways to hide it. And that actually increases, you know, it may reduce the number of people who get radicalized, but the people who remain just get more and more extreme because they're even more isolated from, you know, everyone else. And I don't know, how do you break that that radicalization cycle? Like, how do you stop that shit before it gets, you know, to a tipping point?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I'm with you. I'm pretty skeptical of a lot of de-radicalization strategies. And it's like an incredibly difficult task to pull someone out who's already going down these pathways. And then, like you said, it's also an incredibly difficult task to make sure that when you are disrupting the radicalization networks, that they aren't just disappearing off to some other corner of the internet, mm-hmm. which we know they're doing. Like one of the reasons why we're working with a video game company is over the last few years, we've noticed a big migration into video game platforms. Especially big social-based video game platforms like Roblox and Minecraft, which are not even remotely prepared to deal with, you know, very well-developed, sophisticated radicalization networks. They have moved over there, both for organization and radicalization reasons, since mainstream companies have started taking more of an interest in deplatforming them. And so we are ending up like pretty wildly unprepared for this sudden onslaught of extremists being right in front of kids as they're playing games, or, you know, teenagers or even young adults. So our idea essentially is to use that language, the same language that extremists are trying to adopt via the structures of video games, via the sort of interactivity there, to better communicate the impacts of extremism, what it looks like, how to identify it, and hopefully how to avoid getting, you know, falling into the traps that are laid for unsuspecting people.
One of the issues, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, because we talk a lot about, like, I think people have become increasingly aware of how bad Facebook in particular is as a problem with this. It's really where we owe a lot of the Boogaloo movement to, and now this stuff is coming out about like the data Facebook has had on just, and this is adjacent to radicalization, the mental impact that it's been having on teenagers, right? Like the just how bad it is for people. And I'm wondering, like, how do you scale this stuff, I guess, is the question. Like, how do you make the social internet less dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be extremely tough. And we are even starting very, very small. Like, we're building on a narrative platform to target three high schools right now. Yeah. But the hope is that ultimately what we can do is build a tool set and a platform, like literally a game platform, that can be used by high school teachers and high school classes throughout the country or throughout the world. The idea will be to hopefully make a new sort of package of different methods and interactive experiences that can be reused into the future. But it is one of the big open questions that we will hopefully come to some sort of answer for throughout the project about how do we actually scale this up. But, you know, in general, it is, again, like one of the biggest open questions right now. One of the reasons why I'm so skeptical of a lot of DRAD and CVE techniques is they try to go for scale above effectiveness, when in reality, one of the best and only de-radicalization pathways that we know of involves people that you know and I know going out and meeting with these people one-on-one and having intensive, frequent communications with them. So there's, as far as we know, there's not a good answer right now. This is a huge place of research right now because we just straight up do not understand how to scale up radicalization prevention and de-radicalization.
I mean, and what, you know, what you're trying to do in like reaching kids in high school in something that's meant, they're meant to be consuming while they're in school is even such an additional challenge, because I think you and I are both young enough to at least remember that like almost nothing that you put before kids in that context in a school gets through. I can think about like anti-drug programs and stuff when I was a kid and how ineffective they were. There was, I had one effective anti-drug like speech by a teacher, and it was just a teacher whose son was part of this. There was this one night in Plano where like six kids OD'd on heroin. There was a big Rolling Stone article about it. It was a very famous moment. And her son was one of the kids who nearly died. And she like just explained like physically what happened to him and begged us not to do heroin. And that actually did stick with me. I've never shot up anything. but you know, like a lot of it doesn't work. And I think part of why it's this thing I talked about when I tried to explain like why ISIS propaganda was so effective. It's the it feels more authentic than the counter narrative, right? The counter narrative, because it's usually focus grouped. It's coming as the result of like some sort of government initiative. A bunch of people working together. It feels focus grouped, as opposed to there's something inherently more compelling about something that just like feels like somebody who really gave a shit, cares a lot, put this thing together, even if it's terrible. And that strikes me as a really, because if you're going to be scaling something and trying to reach a lot of people, it's going to have to be something that is put together at scale by an organization. And how do you, I mean, I know this must be on your mind as you're trying to figure out how to craft this thing. I'm just interested in your thoughts on that, really.
Yeah. I mean, that exact challenge is what led us to proposing the project that we are. So the idea behind it, or the impetus behind what we proposed is the exact problem of students just don't listen to people in whether that's anti-drug programs or anything like that. Often my feeling about it is they are often resistant to it because it's very negative. It's very don't do this, don't do this. Setting up boundaries for kids and adolescents to act within. It's all very declaratory, very commanding. There's no sense of treating kids like people who have control, who have interests, who have motivations. It's all attempting to restrict them. And so the idea is that we're going to attempt to build a game platform that actually empowers students to operate within roles that have control, that have something to say, to give them voices, to give them that sort of feeling of being an established person within a certain scenario. The way that I've been thinking about it is that we're basically merging video games with like the structure of a Model UN conference or something like that. Hopefully we'll be a little less nerdy than Model UN conferences, but that's the idea of giving people power to make decisions and treat them like actual, you know, operating humans.
Yeah. I'm wondering, do you have any kind of models that you're looking at when you think of like something that you see as kind of worth, I don't know, emulating maybe the wrong word, but like, oh, these people I think got it right and this was effective. Like, or is this really a situation where you feel like we're kind of in the fucking wilderness here? There's not a lot of great models for what's effective.
We are very much in the wilderness.
Yeah.
That was kind of what I was expecting you to say. Yeah. Like so much of CVE and DRAD work over the last 10 years has been directly towards trying to essentially recreate the DARE model or the anti-drug model, just in a different field. And so we're going to be pulling from scenario builders and like Model UN and debate and like all of these different models that seem to at least work to get kids engaged with like operating in that sort of situation. But it is going to be pretty, I mean, at least from what I understand, it's going to be pretty new. We're going to be out there really flying blind for a lot of it. But we will, you know, we have a pilot phase built in to try to beta test this with some of the students. We're incorporating students and instructors in the actual creation development stage. So that'll be another hopefully good part of this. We'll give some students experience with the game development process, which I think will help engage them as well.
Yeah, that strikes me as a particularly good idea of like giving and also just giving them some agency. So it's not like this is a thing that you are forced to consume. Like this is a thing that you can like learn something from. I think that's very important. I'm interested in how you see this, because like again, we kind of both got in around the same time. Gamergate is when I started paying attention to radicalization too. How do you think it's changed since then? How do you think like the nature of how particularly like younger people are being radicalized has changed? And I guess I'm also interested because I get the feeling that back then it was mostly younger people getting radicalized, and that's no longer the case. Right. You know, I'm just as we're talking, I just came across a video on Twitter of a group of anti-vax protesters chasing parents and children away from an elementary school and screaming at them that they're raping their kids with a vaccine. So clearly, the problem has expanded. But yeah,
yeah, and honestly, one of the things that keeps me up at night is when we start. If you know, knock on wood, we are able to roll this out to more schools, we're going to run into some probably very resistant parents who have been heavily radicalized.
Yeah.
I mean, the big one is like what you said, like the radicalization demographics have vastly expanded to incorporate so many more different types of people, so many more ages and even ethnicities and genders. But what we do know is that the hardcore of the violent extremists are still targeting adolescents. We know accelerationists, for instance, hang out and try to essentially blackpill a bunch of teens, especially autistic teens, especially teens with mental health issues, and bring them into a more violent, more accelerationist posture. So, I mean, I think that has sort of stayed constant throughout all of this. One of the big changes has been platforms. You know, 10 years ago, it was much easier for a neo-Nazi to operate openly on YouTube or Facebook. But that has thankfully changed. But they have spread out into, like I mentioned earlier, they've spread out into video games. They spread out into other sorts of platforms where the social aspect isn't necessarily the first part of the platform, but rather a secondary aspect to it. And they try to engage adolescents on their own turf on, you know, in a Roblox game or in a video game forum out there. Mm-hmm.
It's not even enough to say it feels like the task of reducing radicalization or not even to mention pulling it back, just stopping the process, feels not just like whack-a-mole, but like whack-a-mole when you're surrounded by moles. And I guess that is the thing that keeps me up at night the most, too, is that like the problem has gotten, because of how social media scales, I think in large part, has gotten so much worse than it ever was. And I see these crowds of adults, you know, assembling in, you know, places like Los Angeles, showing up outside of schools to harass people. And like, I don't know what to do about that. Like, part of me thinks, that the only effective long-term answer is to mobilize a larger number of people to show up to, you know, not necessarily confront those people, but make them feel outnumbered, and maybe they'll stop, and that'll start a process where they alter their thinking. Like, I'm thinking kind of back to some aspects of the civil rights movement here, right, where you would have these people show up at schools just try to stop integration and whatnot, and they would be opposed often by larger groups, or they would see the size of the marches in the street. And like, I don't even know if it works that way anymore, if like knowing that, you know, 10-to-1 people think your stance on vaccines is stupid and they're willing to show up to like yell at you, if that would do anything. But I don't know what's going to do. Like, I guess I'm asking you, like, have you figured this out? Cause I don't know what the fuck to do. But we can't close our, obviously you're someone who's trying to confront it directly, but we certainly can't keep ourselves like just pretend it's not going to get worse.
Right. No, totally. And, you know, I often feel like it's almost too far gone, and you know, frequently I worry that we've already passed some sort of, you know, point of no return on radicalization, exploitation of social media. But one of the other things I've also recognized is that when you're in a space that is dedicated to one type of confronting, one method of confronting extremism, very often they will forget about or deprioritize or even ignore the other types, the other methods. And one of the tasks before us, I think, before we throw up our hands and give up, is trying to tie together all of the different facets of resisting extremism, from mm-hmm. the hardcore confrontational doxing and showing up in the streets counter-protesting, which I think is an essential part of it, to working as hard as we can to try to get tech companies to realize what's going on. And then also on the educational side, like what we're doing with this project. Some of the things that make me at least a little bit optimistic is that there is obviously inertia, both intentional and unintentional, at tech companies, but frankly, they are still extremely far behind in understanding how to even do deplatforming on their platforms, how to even identify who to deplatform. Like, the majority of tech companies are still making content moderation decisions on a piece-by-piece basis, specifically looking at content. Mm-hmm. Very few of them are doing actor analysis. Very few of them are doing social network analysis. Very few of them are looking at even the links between, like, off-platform violence and on-platform content. Like, it's they are still very much in the Stone Ages when it comes to content moderation.
And that's so key. When I think about, like, what actually would reduce the harm that these platforms are doing at scale, it's focusing on the actors. And not just like the individual actors, which is part of it, but the patterns that let you tell whether or not someone is like that same actor who's kind of like putting on a different hat, so to speak. Are you aware of, like, is there any, I have not seen that happen yet. I haven't seen Facebook take that seriously. And I have spent some time there. I haven't seen Twitter take that seriously. I haven't really seen, I don't believe TikTok is like they're just, like you said, they're taking it on a piece by piece basis, which is never, there's too many pieces. That's never going to handle the problem.
Right. Yeah. I mean, TikTok is crawling right now. They're in their infancy. Mm-hmm. They don't have a data sharing, any sort of data sharing system set up for researchers or anything like that yet. I've seen optimistic signals. So I think Facebook's approach to QAnon and Boogaloo movement over the past year has been probably the best, the most positive development we've seen on the content moderation front, because they took an actual network-based approach to it. Mm-hmm. It was hamstrung by a variety of different policy decisions, but it was still, from a mechanics standpoint, the most sophisticated one any of the companies has actually talked about openly. And YouTube has followed in their path. They've started taking more network approaches. They've taken moderation action against QAnon on a similar basis. But the thing that I want tech companies to start looking at is applying a lot of the techniques they're using for disinformation and info ops work to extremism and radicalization. It's very similar, but right now it seems to be just easier politically, or just they are further along with doing the large-scale network analysis approaches on disinfo. Like, Twitter is doing a lot of that, but it's all on information operations and authentic info.
Yeah, as opposed to, And I worry, too, because I'm paying attention to kind of, you know, you have this whistleblower from Facebook and how that's being politicized, right? How the right is kind of coming at this from a, they're trying to say, like, as Ben Shapiro said, they're trying to censor alternative media voices and the like. And I worry tremendously about the politicization, because number one, it means that at best we've got like 3 years to get something together before, you know, who knows who winds up in the White House next. But also, if it's just this thing of like veering between who gets paid attention to based on like what is politically viable for Facebook, we're never going to solve the problem. And I think I agree with you for the most part on the Facebook's response to the Boogaloo movement. I mean, I guess I think the problem was that by the time they developed a functional set of responses to it, it had metastasized. It had grown strong enough to exist on its own, and a lot of people had gotten exposed. what do you think is the actual, is reasonable to expect in terms of response time from these people? Because with Boogaloo stuff, it was about, I want to say about 3 months, maybe, well, no, it was more like five. It was about 5 months that it had from like December of 2019 was when I started really noticing it. And then like, you know, May at the, when stuff really kicked off with the George Floyd protests is when you started to see action taken, the tail end of May. Yeah. So I guess that I'm wondering, like, what is the half-life of this shit? Like, how quickly do you need to crack down on this stuff before it gets to be impossible to contain?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest limiting factor on the effectiveness of content moderation in general, but also in particular, these new approaches that the tech companies seem to be experimenting with. My understanding is that part of the, so I'm not defending Facebook by any stretch. I'm not here to
be
the Facebook rallying crew, but my understanding is that they literally did develop an entirely separate approach to taking down the Boogaloo movement. So that explains at least a little bit of the delay. But hopefully, you know, my optimistic side hopes that they'll be able to apply it more quickly in the future. The problem is a lot of the network approaches that have been developed have like these very high thresholds for attribution. So it has to be like a dedicated network that has crossed the line into criminal activity and is actively calling for, you know, political violence on like a network level. And that, like, we all know that is like the end goal or the end point in
the terminal at that stage.
Exactly. Right. Like, that is the terminal point of the development of these extremist networks. So, you know, we're one of the things that we're working on is trying to figure out a way to convince tech companies that you can and should take action earlier before it reaches that point. And it's going to be a mosaic of things. It's going to be combining violent extremism with hate speech, with even like CSAM child exploitation stuff, with all of, you know, criminal conspiracy network policies. All of those things need to be sort of thought of as pieces in a single big overarching umbrella that we can use to take down networks earlier on. But, you know, that's one of the biggest tasks, is just convincing them to think about it much, much earlier.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think most of what I wanted to get into today. Is there anything else you really wanted to like kind of talk about while you're here?
Those are the big ones for sure. We will hopefully have more to talk about very soon in how we're approaching this project. It's going to be a pretty big project, and it'll take 2 years to implement, but we're pretty excited to see what comes out of it.
Yeah. Well, people can find you on Twitter at Alex Newhouse, right?
Alex B. Newhouse.
Alex B. Newhouse, yeah. At Alex B. Newhouse. They can check out where you work at CTECMIIS. And yeah, I'm excited to see. Maybe we'll have you back on when you you actually put out the game, but I'm really interested in looking at that. Oh yeah, what was the last thing you brewed?
Oh, I brewed a red IPA, and I'm currently brewing 3 gallons of apple cider.
Oh, nice. We just we juiced 10 gallons of apples and pears that I just kegged after almost 4 weeks of fermentation.
I've been looking at apple mills, like apple presses. And
yeah,
like, I should just buy one.
And we found one to rent, so it was just like, I don't know, $30 for the day, and we just gathered up all the apples on property. But it was rad. Definitely very soothing. Yeah, we were juicing all of the apples the day that Tiny got shot at that protest in Olympia. So it was just like looking at the Twitter, saying there's been a shooting at a protest, and being like, yeah, I'm glad I'm not working today.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm glad I'm not working today.
Just having an idyllic afternoon pressing apples. Yeah.
This is a more enjoyable use of my time right now. All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much for being on. Thank you for what you're doing. And thank you all for listening. Go with, you know, whoever, whatever deity, up to you.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.